Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, June 3rd, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests, Amy Blackmore at the helm of the 30th annual Montreal Fringe Festival, a mix of virtual and in-person shows.
She said to me early on in the pandemic that, you know, 98% of an artist's job happens off stage. And I think it's true, but I think folks are really ready to live that 2%.
Johanna Netter on a dinner party conversation as art and what talking about reconciliation could look like.
So Nadia had some other settler artists at the residency. Actually, I think they were a community theater group in the Gaspé. And she had them read the verbatim transcript from the conversation as a script, as a way to mitigate racism. And it was really interesting.
Choreographer and dancer Kathleen Tardif on creating a new work in reverse.
La création s'est faite d'une façon tellement organique et fusionnelle, je dirais, même si ça fait un peu ésotérique, là, mais ça s'est fait d'une façon tellement naturelle que c'est presque difficile à expliquer comment on a travaillé ensemble.
What a difference a few weeks can make in a city. While today is gray and rainy in Montreal, curfew is over. Terrasses are open. It's hot out. The Habs are into round two of the playoffs, and there is so much to see and do in the arts. And this coming Monday, Montreal and Laval also jump to orange zone after many months labeled as red or the highest COVID alert level. This means a few more measures will be relaxed. But in any case, the FTA is on and the fringe is on and there's a lot to see and do. Let's get to it. It's the early 90s in Montreal. Jean Doré is mayor. The Expos play ball at the Big O. And there are questions swirling about whether the Anglo theater scene is dead. Enter two McGill students, fresh off a trip to the Edmonton Fringe Festival. They propose that launching an indie arts festival in the summertime, like in Edmonton, with no censorship and a bare budget, is the way to go. And so, the Montreal Fringe Festival began in 1990 in the heart of the Plateau Montréal. And skipping last year's sort of pandemic hiatus fest, the organizers are marking this edition as the big 30th birthday party. It is a bit different. There's no beer tent, there's no daily 13th hour show, no flyers or paper tickets, as the team plotted out a festival that is pandemic friendly, but also increasingly eco-conscious. Amy Blackmore is the festival's artistic and executive director. I spoke with Amy earlier this week on launch day, Tuesday, to talk about what you can expect from the Fringe Festival. Here is our conversation. Welcome, Amy, to Upstage. Today is launch day. How are you feeling?
I'm so excited. It's very exciting. I'm happy to be here.
So normally on day one of the Fringe, what would you be doing? Like, you would probably have had a couple of really long days leading up to this point. You might be subsisting on snacks and fumes and vapors. But how does today compare for you personally, Amy, as head of the festival, compared to what you would normally be going through?
Wow. I mean, there are things that are the same and things that are completely different. I mean, you know, I'm just kind of trying to be available to my staff to help support them wherever they're needed. But like a real big change is, you know, typically around 4 p.m. on Fringe for All Day, I'm making sandwiches for the journalists that come. I like to make like egg and onion sandwiches. And I like to be the one to like cut up the little like, you know, food things for our Senka set that we do for media. It keeps me busy while everyone's doing the real work.
Oh, wow. That is a detail I didn't expect to hear from you, that you're actually making sandwiches. So that'll be something you'll get back to next year. I don't usually talk business on Upstage about shows and how they're doing and stuff. I almost feel like it's a sensitive thing to ask an artist, or how are ticket sales doing, or unless, you know, something's sold out. But, you know, I think this is kind of part and parcel of putting on a show in a pandemic. You have good news that you announced today for the launch. in terms of ticket sales. Oh my gosh,
amazing news. It's so thrilling to see how folks are embracing the Fringe this year. This morning, we announced that we were at over $10,000 in ticket sales, but I can confirm that we've already passed, we just surpassed 12,000. So tickets are moving very quickly.
So the key takeaway for audience members is...
Get them now. You know, it's a different kind of Fringe Festival this year, right? And I think the thing to remember is that for the in-person shows, there's reduced capacity at venues. So, you know, we don't have 100 seats available. In some venues, we only have 12 seats available. So it's really important to plan in advance, book your ticket now, because you don't want to be disappointed.
Yeah, so I think for people who might be, you know, because it's been so many months since we've A, been able to leave our house after a certain time in the evening and B, be around other people. What do you need to know in terms of like what's available to audience members? There is content online, but there's also shows in person and we want people to go in person.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the most important thing to know is that this year at the Fringe, it's all about choice. I think we recognize that something important about the Fringe is that it is the one time of year that a lot of folks do come out to see theater. We cast quite the wide net, and what we've And what we've realized is that the Fringe is going to be the entry point for a lot of folks coming back to theater. So we just wanted there to be as many options as possible available. So yeah, you can go to montrealfringe.ca and check out the lineup. But we have 5 in-person venues with 154 performances from June 10th to 20th. We've got about 30 companies that are presenting as a part of that. And that's for the real in-person experience. But you can also just Fringe with us online. We've got an amazing lineup of on-demand content on our new Fringe TV website.
I'm curious to know about what venues are being used this year. Are you going to different venues this time around, or going back to some of the old haunts, but kind of, you know, obviously cutting back on the number of seats that can be used?
Yeah, I mean, there's a healthy mix of venues this year. We have 5. We have La Chapelle, which is always one of my favorites to sit in, Pitsy Campus, Mainline Theater, and then we've actually added 2 venues at Monument National. So we're really excited to be at Monument for the first time. Nice. It's a new partnership, and, you know.
This is so strange because it almost feels like it's condensed. A lot of the times you could plan out an evening of shows and you might be whipping down from La Chapelle all the way up to, the space on Saint Laurent above Mount Royal and then whipping back down again to Petit Campus. But it's a bit more concentrated, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it makes for a stronger hub, having the venues all close together like this. And, you know, I think that one of the big things I keep saying to my staff, and I'm going to remind myself when I'm attempting to run from venue to venue, is it's going to be the Fringe. It's going to be the Fringe that we all love and enjoy, but it's going to feel a little different. And we just wanted to try and make things a little easier on folks we keep talking about radical hospitality as the approach this year. We want everyone to know what they're getting into so that they can enjoy their experience.
I'm speaking with Amy Blackmore, Executive and Artistic Director at the Saint-Ambroise Montreal Fringe Festival. So in terms of programming the festival, the famous thing is that you enter a lottery and you find out if you're going to get in, and then no one is going to tell you what to do or how to shape your show, right? Besides the workshops and the guidance you do offer. So how was this year booking artists and setting things up? How was it different and how is it similar to years past?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it has been such a long process for some of these artists. You know, what happened was around March 26, when all the venues in Montreal were allowed to relaunch and reopen, it really hit us that we needed to do this Fringe in person and hold our event. So we offered spots to artists that were in the festival or scheduled to be in the festival in 2020. And about a dozen of them said, yes, we want to participate. Thank you. And then we actually held a lottery in April, and we had about 30 artists apply. We took around a dozen of those. And I think what's really special about it is that there's a whole group of artists that have created their show in a month and a half.
Wow.
So you couldn't be fresher than this year's Fringe, you know, with such a condensed process. And I mean, I was worried at one point, I thought, oh my goodness, it's going to be the year of all the COVID shows at the Fringe. Yeah. But that's not actually what we're seeing. We're seeing really? A huge range of work. Pretty excited.
So, and to explain that a little bit further, I guess what you were expecting was a lot of people having been cooped up for a year were going to advance, like, this is my year where I sat down and wrote a play, or what I learned between baking sourdough bread and like repainting my whole house.
But that's you just wrote your Fringe show. Exactly. And you know, it's funny, like, I think we've all been like waiting to see what the content's going to be, because one thing that is true that hasn't changed is we aren't censoring our artists whatsoever. And you know, yet again, I don't know what we're going to actually even have until the festival until I see the Fringe for all tonight. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to even predict. We do have rules that we had to impose, obviously, for sanitary reasons. But, you know, all the artists have been so understanding about it. And they just want to have a safe environment where they can play and have a really great moment with an audience.
And so what is the vibe that you're getting from artists, the ones that you have spoken with? You know, do people feel like this is my time to relaunch? You know, because there have been shows sporadically for the last couple of months, and there's been online content as well. But really, we are not 100% back yet in terms of live art. So is the vibe like, I'm getting back into the swing of things, or I miss this so much?
Oh, I think the vibe is the crave to be in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. You know, I know a lot of folks have been working, doing artist residencies, you know, doing things on their own. But there are also others that have done nothing at all year. There's definitely a huge range. But what I am hearing is that they're looking forward to that moment when they are face-to-face with the audience. And, you know, it's funny, like I always quote Helen Simard, who is a former president of Mainline Theatre. And, you know, she said to me early on in the pandemic that, you know, 98% of an artist's job happens off stage. And I think it's true, but I think folks are really ready to live that 2%.
Wow. I can imagine that people would be feeling rusty, but also excited. And I suppose that experience will be different for everyone. And the nice thing about the Fringe, right, is that you can just ask them after you see the show, you know, keeping your distance and wearing a mask. Who's to say, you know, if you're curious about that, you can just ask someone right after they've finished putting on their pandemic play. I'm speaking with Amy Blackmore, executive and artistic director of the Fringe Festival. The other huge part of this, Amy, is that it is the 30th anniversary of the Fringe. Congratulations.
Yay. Thank you. I mean, I wasn't working for the Fringe when it was founded, but I'm happy to continue on the legacy.
Well, I think as the, you know, titular head, right, you get to take the accolades as it is. Yes, because there have been different people running it and lots of different faces. I mean, it's inevitable over three decades, right? Do you feel a twinge of sadness that the 30th is happening at this extraordinary time?
Oh, you know what? At a certain point, I did, but I don't anymore. I think that we've all been cooped up all winter in our houses, and we're ready to celebrate the 30th. There's something about nostalgia that tastes good, you know? So it's, I keep thinking of the 30th as a way to remember, look back into photos. And we're actually going to be asking the public to help us with this. We want folks to use the hashtag FringeMTL and share us like photos of your tickets that you have lying around in your house from like 1992. You know, old photos of you volunteering at the festival. Like we want to reminisce. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what it means to reminisce about the event and the festival. And for me, it's really helped me look forward, you know, being able to project into the future by looking back. So there's some sort of like emotional magic happening around the anniversary. And for me, I think, especially as someone who's been around or who's been on staff for more than 10 years, taking time to think about what the Fringe ultimately stands for has really allowed me to be able to get through this as a staff member. And it's because I'm not going to lie, it hasn't been easy organizing this event this year. But at the end of the day, I'm reminded of the Fringe mandate and, you know, giving the money back 100% of the box office to the artists, keeping prices affordable, no censorship, promoting multiculturalism and more. And that's one thing that has been unchanged from the beginning of our event. And I hope that it will continue to be unchanged for the next 30 years. It's pretty exciting to think about it that way.
I sure hope so as well. I have to ask you, Amy, 30th anniversary, you have a long relationship with the festival. It's not a normal year. What are you personally looking forward to in terms of an experience? Is it seeing a show in particular, or is it the Fringe for All, or watching the money roll in? Like, what are you looking forward to this month?
Wow, what a great question. I think for me, I'm looking the most forward to putting on my walkie-talkie. it's a really nice moment when I get to put it on. But, you know, all jokes aside, you know, on Thursday the 10th at 6 p.m. when all the shows will be open for the first time, I'm just looking forward to actually listening to my walkie and hearing, you know, the front of house staff announce that doors are now closed for X show. I'm looking forward to that.
The chatter on the walkie-talkie, and that is the accessory, aside from a Fringe shirt, I think, for being on staff and for being a volunteer as well, is to have that walkie-talkie, that some of that magic that you're talking about there.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, like we didn't get to have walkie-talkies last year, and they came super early this year, so we've been playing with them as we get ready for it. But I'm also just really looking forward to listening to our podcast, the Fringe Buzz Lab, which I know that you know all about because you're actually the host of our podcast.
That's right, Amy. Yes, I'm so thrilled to be part of that journey, and I'm hoping that for people it'll be and I'm honored to have been asked and to participate. And I'm hoping that it'll be a kind of a substitute in a way for missing out on some of the normal conversations or the catching up that you would normally expect at the festival, but also filling in the blanks for some people who may not know how the festival got started. I learned a lot about the experience and talking to artists about how it was founded and what people have taken away from it. And I'm just so honored that I was part of that. And we have two episodes out now, I think, already, and more to come. And Véronique Raymond being the co-host on doing French episodes and English episodes. So accessible no matter your mother tongue.
So excited about that project.
Amy Blackmore, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I hope I can see you or bump into you at some point in the festival. Even though we're all wearing masks, it's always... you're an unmistakable figure to see because I'll look for your walkie-talkie and that feeling of like everything's under control. That's Amy Blackmore.
Oh, thanks so much. And yeah, like I just want to say, like, get your passes now. Like, there's bonus content online for folks if you buy a pass. So we just hope that that you'll join us.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Amy. That was Amy Blackmore, Artistic and Executive Director of the Fringe Festival. I'll be bringing you more coverage of shows next week, but if you want to grab your tickets now, do it. As Amy mentioned, some shows have limited audiences, so it's best to get your tickets in advance. And of course, you can always see shows with Fringe TV online and at home. MontrealFringe.ca is the place to go. Many in-person shows launch June 10th, a week from today, and the festival celebrating the history and influence of the festival through the eyes of people who were there from the get-go and those who had their careers shaped by the festival. You can check it out on iTunes and Spotify. Look up Labo Fringe Buzz or Fringe Buzz Lab. Let me know what you think. You can find me on Twitter at Sarah Day. Several episodes are already out. And again, MontrealFringe.ca to plot out your tickets and your festival. I'm Sarah Day, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, creating a dance show in reverse. So lighting, design, then set, then dance? How does that work? I'll bring you a choreographer who went through that interesting process. Last week, we learned that a mass grave was located at a residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia. Authorities believe it contains the bodies of 215 children sent away to the school, never to return home, between 1900 and 1971. Ottawa now says they want to spend millions to search for grave sites at other residential schools, of which six were located in Quebec. We live in a country where, to varying degrees, people have different understandings of our past. Members of First Nations this week have said that they were shocked and saddened, but not surprised by the news in BC, because they know firsthand how deadly and how damaging the school system was, and they still grapple with its fallout as survivors and as members of their communities. Some settler Canadians know of the past not because it was taught in school, but because of plays like Children of God by Corey Payette, a powerful musical about OG Cree children who were taken to a residential school in Northern Ontario, performed at the Siegel in 2020. Or the work of the late Gord Downey of the Tragically Hip, who worked in the final years of his life to share the story of Channy Wenjack, a little boy who died trying to escape his school, with the collaboration of Channy's family. And there are many more of us who know nothing at all. And it's time for non-Indigenous Canadians to take it upon ourselves to learn and to listen about this country's past and what these people went through, and understand that the terror unleashed by colonial powers still reverberates today. There are many steps to take. There's a lot of work to do. But I believe art has a role here. Storytelling as a way to share, to learn, to heal. We need to support and patronize the work of First Nations artists wherever possible. A double bill this week at the MAI explores reconciliation and the conversation between colonizers and the colonized. It's a collaboration years in the making between two friends and artists. We have Nadia Mir, a contemporary visual artist, an Algonquin member of the Kitiganzibi Anishinaabeg First Nation. Her work focuses on identity, resilience, and the politics of belonging. It can be found at the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts, the National Gallery, the Musée des Civilisations Quebec City, just to name a few places. And her friend, Johanna Nutter, Montrealer, theater maker, and writer, and a past guest of Upstage, she's a seventh-generation European settler descent. You may have seen her incredible one-woman show, My Pregnant Mother, and its follow-up. Their presentation is actually two parts, a casual reconstruction and strike through. The first show is a reenactment of a conversation Nadia recorded between six people, some of Indigenous heritage and some of other backgrounds, a conversation about colonialism that gets reenacted for the audience. Then, in Strike Through, Johanna and Mir engage in a playful exchange about the former, looping in their own lives and further exploring reconciliation. I spoke with Johanna Nutter last Friday. Welcome back to Upstage, Johanna. It's so nice to speak with you. How are you doing today?
It's so nice to speak with you too, Sarah. We have a long history of speaking with each other, and it's very nice to be back in your presence.
I'll preface that we bumped into each other casually in the park, two meters or so apart. And I have to say, you are a very enthusiastic person, but the enthusiasm and the energy that you had in just like briefly talking about this show without going into too much detail was palpable. I could feel your energy. It sounds like you're really happy to be working on something right now. Is that right?
Yeah. I was thinking about this just the other day, but I've often, artists I admire will sometimes talk about their life's work, you know, one piece becomes kind of their life's work. And for a long time, I thought that was My Pregnant Brother, My Playwright Sister. But I've been working on this piece for 4 years, and it's really starting to get somewhere that I'm very proud of. Yeah, I mean, for whatever part I play in it, I'm just really, really excited about the work. Yeah.
Let's talk about stamina for a second. Is it uncommon to be working on a project like this as a performer and someone who really thinks about their work, you know, like to be working on something for this long, for that many years? Is that unusual?
Well, I think to be working on something that evolves that so much, that is always changing and always new, is unusual. I mean, oftentimes people will build a performance piece or a piece of theater to tour and will tour it as is for many years, which is what I've done and how I've managed to stay a full-time performer. But I've often wondered, it's kind of curious that theater ends up being so ephemeral so much of the time. Like in opera, and many, many different people will perform something for, you know, hundreds of years. Different people will give it a try. But to actually stay with something in the theater is less common. Yeah.
And also to see that you're just talking about the evolution and it getting to a certain point that you're happy about. I just think it probably takes so much perseverance and a lot of hard work to see that evolution as well and to stick with something.
Yeah. And what's really great about that is that I find myself, I wouldn't use the word relaxing because it's not exactly that, but kind of settling into being in a state of response. Like our work really responds to our environment in a very immediate way. And that's been really clear in the past year because we've had this situation, this global situation, that that meant that we really had to change the way we were thinking about presenting the show. We had been scheduled to perform the show here at the Mai, which has been kind of our home since the beginning because they gave us a residency 4 years ago that started the whole process. And we really were happy to bring it back to the Mai after taking it to a festival in London, England. And then theaters closed down and we couldn't. So instead we brought it online at the Ofthea last May. And we discovered so many exciting things about actually being in these boxes together, dramaturgically, thematically for us. It just had a lot to offer.
We'll get back into the show itself in just a moment, but I want to first meet your co-conspirator here, Nadia Mir. And it's important, your friendship, I think, because you end up bringing up both of your histories into the story. So she's a contemporary visual artist. You are a theater creator, a performer. How did you both end up meeting each other and becoming friends?
Well, it was a long time ago. Back in the 90s, in the early 90s, there was a kind of artistic cultural scene that grew up around the Maine that was really, really wild and undisciplined, I think is the word for it. Because you know how now we really have artists are more in these silos like music or theater, and then there's interdisciplinary work. But back then, it was just a group of people who all kind of hung out together and were just very interested in art, no matter what form it took. We would go to ballet, poetry readings, openings in galleries, and Nadia was one of those artists. And I was not quite allowing myself to be an artist at that point, but I was everyone's bartender. So I think we met because she would often come to Elsa's to work. And that's where I worked.
Elsa's Cafe on Roy Street. Oh my gosh. Interesting to know that the history of the place a little bit and to hear about the kind of collaborations or meetings that have happened in that space before. So your friendship developed over the years. How did you decide to actually collaborate together though? And I think we might pull the threads of what you were talking about earlier about the development of the show and talking about important conversations that we're trying to have in so many different spaces, but here we are talking about it within a cultural space. So how did you and Nadia end up wanting to shift into creating together?
Well, she had created an installation work called A Casual Reconstruction when she was in the Gaspé at a residency there, where she staged a dinner conversation between herself and five people who were Mi'kmaq and other. And Nadia herself is Anishinaabe, Algonquin. And so, yeah, they talked about the challenges of identity within the construct of colonialism. And then around that area, it's quite a complicated history in terms of identity, and there's quite a bit of racism. So Nadia had some other settler artists at the residency. Actually, I think there were a community theater group in the Gaspé, and she had them read the verbatim transcript from the conversation as a script, as a way to mitigate racism. And it was really interesting. So she started trying that out in galleries in Quebec City, in New York, Seattle. And I bumped into her at an event that Playwrights was holding. And she told me about it. And she said, I kind of feel like I'm making theater. Do you know anyone you could introduce me to about making a piece of theater? So I introduced her to Emma Tobaldo, and they were talking and I was listening. And then a couple of days later, I called her up and I said, what about me? can we do this together? And that's when we started the work. And
I've honestly thought that when she said, hey, do you know anybody who could help me do theater? I thought you were going to say, well, me, I raised my hand. But instead you introduced her to another very accomplished, wonderful person we've heard on Upstage before, Emma Tobaldo. And then it took a little while, but you then put yourself forward, thank goodness.
Yeah. I think I dreamt about it. I actually did. I dreamt about working with Nadia, and then we went out for soup and talked about it and ended up deciding to work on the project. And at first it was kind of just figuring out really how best to dramatize the conversation was our main goal. But as we were working together, we discovered that we just had so many things in common, and started getting more personal with the work. And out of that evolved a second piece where Nadia and I actually make a play, the two of us.
I'm speaking with Johanna Nutter, who is the co-creator of a hybrid piece that is both in person and online, and there's two parts to it, a casual reconstruction and strike through. And so now we're going to get into strike through as well. So this is more of a dialogue between the both of you. And this is interesting to be bringing in different kinds of dialogue, casual reconstruction being an actual conversation that happened over the dinner table. And here in strike through, you are two longtime friends talking about racism and concerns over Indigenous versus settler culture, but you're also bringing, it's also personal. You're talking about your own stories here.
Yeah. And I wouldn't actually, you know, the conversation is the conversation. And I just came from a rehearsal where six amazing artists from Montreal, Ottawa, from various backgrounds, were all together practicing. There'll be a different group of six people for each show. And these people will be putting the conversation together live in front of the both online and in theater audience for the first time, because they actually only have individual scripts. So they don't get the whole story until they actually meet online.
Almost like a TV show, like Game of Thrones, where we don't want the plot lines to come out. So actors only get their parts, right? Yeah. So the full impact is really only going to be revealed through the actual performance.
And these are all very brave, open-hearted people, because we recognize that at this time, a lot of people are nervous and about saying the wrong thing, so they don't say anything. And right, that's kind of the main point for me, at any rate, of doing this work, is we need to help people to get over that and to really start a dialogue, start to speak about what the situation is that we have here, and how we can fix it.
I'd also like to just kind of set the scene of what you can expect by seeing it, because I've seen a photo of the dialogue of a casual reconstruction, because it's I don't know if you would call it documentary theater, but the participants are going to be reading words that other people have said. I saw an image where they're wearing almost like pennies, but something that you put over.
Yeah, we call them pennies.
Yeah, Yeah, if you're playing one sports team versus another, you're putting on something and you've got a name on the back. And is that really what was the intent there? And how are you setting the scene to kind of show that this is a real conversation, but it's being reenacted?
Well, we just tell people that's what the situation is. And Nadia, for a little while, we were inviting people directly from the audience to come, and Nadia would select who would have which part, and we would do that, perform the reconstruction live without any preparation. But we realized that it just works better if people are a little bit more comfortable and have a little bit more time with the text. Also, since we developed the individual scripts, that it's just really good for us to know that we're all on the same page. And those pennies were designed by Ellen Ewing, who's just a brilliant costume designer. And they were mainly as a way for people. It's kind of a permission. When you put on a costume, it's a permission. And it also helps the characters to know who the other ones are, because their names are right there. And it helps the audience as well to keep track. Right. For the online version, we have online costumes. We have virtual costumes. And that's a lot of fun too. Yeah.
One thought that has occurred to me, and I guess this will be my last question or point, but we talk about being Canadian as kind of like a culture where we're polite, and maybe we gloss over some of the harder or more difficult parts of our past and our current lives. And yeah. What you were saying before about kind of addressing uncomfortable things and making people be okay with that discomfort, it's almost the way you're doing this to me, it seems like a very Canadian way to kind of confront those challenges.
Huh. I honestly don't know what Canada means. Yeah. I used to, when I was a little kid, I remember turning on the TV early in the morning and holding on to the antenna so I could get the picture, and watching the sign on and singing "Oh Canada," but I don't know what that means anymore. I really don't. I understand what you're getting at, you know, and it's a big part of kind of what we send up in our second part, is that Canadian-ness a bit, but yeah, especially living in Quebec.
It's a very complicated time to be talking about ideas of nations and languages.
And languages, like, especially with girls.
I'm entirely with you with that. And I strongly feel that pieces like this and works like these can only help to further those discussions, even if it obviously makes people uncomfortable. But it is a step towards hopefully greater understanding, and hopefully making people who feel like they haven't been heard feel heard, and people who don't have a broad experience broadening that experience of what's going on in the world.
Yeah, and language is even more complicated when it is used as a tool of oppression, as it was used with many First Nations, and in particular, many of the people at the dinner table in the conversation experienced separation from family members because they were divided along linguistic lines.
Thank you so much for coming on to speak with me and to tell me about A Casual Reconstruction and Strike Through.
Well, thank you for helping to get the word out. I really appreciate it.
That was Johanna Netter, co-creator of Strike Through, which follows a casual reconstruction. The double bill between Johanna and Nadia Mir, the two artists and friends, airs this week at the Mai, both in person and live. And Johanna stressed to me that the experience is amazing whether you're in person or at home. It's been devised specifically to give you an equal experience no matter how you see it. So that being said, tickets for the in-person show this week are sold out, but you can still purchase tickets for the two remaining shows online Friday and Saturday afternoon. Info and tickets at the Mai website, m-a-i.qc.ca. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. A choreographer will start with several ideas, working with their own body and their dancers, possibly bringing in outside eyes to look at the movements and the ideas. Then the designers come in to work on sound, on light, and the set. But in La Jamais Sombre, a trio of artists with a long history of collaboration decided to work in reverse, playing with the poetics of light. The show is opening next week as part of the festival Transamérique on Now. Michelle F. Cote is the sound designer, Marc Parent responsible for lighting, and Catherine Tardif, the quote, guardian of movement and the female body, aka choreographer and dancer. The trio has worked together in the past through the company A Marion et Simon, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. They each view each other as equal artists and stakeholders in this new show, La Jamais Sombre. I spoke with Catherine last Friday, and our conversation is in French. Donc bonjour et bienvenue Catherine à Upstage. Merci beaucoup d'avoir pris le temps de me parler aujourd'hui. Ça va bien?
Oui, ça va très bien, merci.
C'est très intéressant de voir que le processus était un peu différent pour ce projet en comparaison à d'autres projets dont vous avez travaillé. En effet, d'habitude, c'est la personne qui s'occupe de la lumière, ça arrive plus tard dans le processus. Mais là, on a commencé avec le travail de Marc Parent pour ce projet, c'est bien ça?
C'est exactement ça. En fait, à l'origine, pour essayer de faire une histoire courte, on voulait, Michel F. Cote, qui est co-directeur artistique de la compagnie Marianne et Simon, que je dirige également avec lui. Donc, Michel et moi-même, on avait envie de travailler avec Marc et on voulait aussi que nous ayons Michel, Marc et moi, chacun un statut de soliste, en fait. Michel me talonnait depuis plusieurs années pour que je me fasse un solo, puis ça ne m'avait jamais vraiment intéressée parce que ce que j'aime, moi, c'est de partager la scène avec d'autres ou de diriger des interprètes. Donc, ça ne me tentait pas du tout de faire un solo. Et finalement, à force de réfléchir au projet, on s'est dit, OK, solo, pourquoi pas, mais à condition que ça se passe dans des conditions où je vais me sentir accompagnée par d'autres solistes. Alors, c'est la solution, en gros, qu'on a trouvée. Et il s'avère qu'effectivement, les répétitions ont commencé tout de suite en résidence technique, ce qui veut dire qu'on avait à notre disposition un studio équipé dès la première semaine de répétition. Alors, c'est un petit peu ce qui a fait en sorte que Marc s'est lancé tout de suite, en fait. Puis je pense qu'il avait peut-être besoin de briser la glace parce que ça l'intimidait un petit peu, effectivement, de se retrouver comme idéateur. Parce que, comme tu l'as si bien dit, Sarah, en général, les éclairagistes arrivent assez tard dans le processus. Ils réagissent à une pièce qui est déjà faite, alors que là, Marc devait se lancer dans des idées pures, dans des concepts complètement personnels à lui. Et j'ajoute que Michel a fait de même aussi. Il est arrivé un peu plus tard, cependant, avec des propositions musicales. Mm-hmm. Et sonores.
Donc, assez pour moi aussi, Marc avec son travail avec l'éclairage, ensuite Michel avec le son. Là, vous, Catherine, est venue sur la scène. Qu'est-ce que Marc et Michel vous a présenté au début? Je suis très curieuse de savoir comment le processus, alors, le démarche, alors, a progressé. Est-ce que là, vous mettiez sur scène en regardant le son, en regardant l'éclairage et entendre le son, puis ensuite, votre travail comme chorégraphe, ça commence?
C'est un mélange, en fait, de tout ça. Je vais essayer d'être le plus clair possible, Sarah, mais ça a été tellement... Je tiens à dire que la création s'est faite d'une façon tellement organique et fusionnelle, je dirais, même si ça fait un peu ésotérique, là, mais ça s'est fait d'une façon tellement naturelle que c'est presque difficile à expliquer comment on a travaillé ensemble. Mais... Donc, reprenons du début. Comme je te disais, on a commencé par une résidence technique et Marc nous a fait une ou deux propositions qui ont tout de suite lancé l'esprit de la pièce, en fait. Ce qu'on cherche à faire avec La Jamais Sombre, c'est de travailler sur les perceptions du spectateur, en fait. On travaille beaucoup sur l'obscurité, sur le difficile à voir, l'impossible à ne pas voir. On travaille beaucoup sur une espèce de... En fait, l'idée première de Marc, c'était de travailler sur l'obscurité, en fait. Et donc, les propositions étaient si fortes que effectivement, moi, je me suis demandé quelle serait la place du corps dans ça. Et on a fait beaucoup d'explorations au niveau de la lumière, surtout pendant cette première semaine avec Marc, parce que c'était un petit peu notre colonne vertébrale, si tu veux. Et la semaine de travail qui a suivi après, c'était une semaine de résidence sèche. On était en studio sans éclairage du tout. Et là, moi, je me disais, est-ce qu'on va pouvoir continuer à être en dialogue, même si là, on n'a plus d'accès à l'éclairage? Et ça a fait en sorte que, porté par l'expérience qu'on avait eue de cette première semaine avec les propositions de Marc, il s'est engagé un dialogue entre nous trois qui est resté très vivant, en fait. On a réfléchi à comment réagir aux scènes que Marc nous a proposées, mais aussi Michel, lui, s'était donné comme exercice d'arriver tous les jours avec une nouvelle proposition sonore, à laquelle moi, je réagissais à chaud tout de suite aussi, sans l'avoir entendue. Et cette musique, il s'avère que ça l'a beaucoup inspiré Marc aussi pour les semaines de résidence suivantes, parce qu'il faut dire qu'on a eu beaucoup de résidences techniques. Et Marc est arrivé en fait avec des tableaux directement inspirés des propositions sonores que Michel avait proposé pendant notre deuxième semaine, qui était donc une semaine en studio normal, sans éclairage. Et aussi, il s'avère qu'à la réaction de mes deux complices, bien, on a répertorié des moments d'improvisation faits soit par Michel, moi-même, un tout petit peu par Marc aussi, qui ont servi à nourrir aussi des tableaux plus physiques qui ont été proposés par moi. Alors, comme tu vois, ça a été une espèce d'imbriquement permanent. C'est une espèce de tour à 360 degrés. Presque à chaque idée qu'on avait, on essayait toujours de converger les trois un vers l'autre.
C'est fascinant. C'est comme un procès très graduel, il me semble, comme vous êtes en train d'ajouter une layer upon layer. Comme c'est lent, mais... vous incorporez tous les trois à la même fois. Je parle avec la chorégraphe Catherine Tardif au sujet de La Jamais Sombre, la pièce pour le Festival Transamérique. Ça commence le 9 juin, starting June 9th. On parle beaucoup de la lumière et ainsi chiaroscuro. Est-ce que vous pouvez me parler un petit peu au sujet de pourquoi le chiaroscuro est devenu comme un point de départ dans votre conversation au sujet de la lumière?
Déjà, comme je dis, pendant nos toutes premières réunions, avant même de commencer le travail, Marc nous avait manifesté son désir de travailler sur l'obscurité. Alors, nous, ça nous intéressait beaucoup. avec tout ce que ça implique quand on parle d'obscurité, je trouve qu'il y a il y a tout de suite une appréhension. On peut penser à la nuit, à l'enfance, les peurs nocturnes, la quiétude, la beauté, mais aussi des fois une frayeur quand on pense à l'infini de l'espace, quand on regarde les étoiles. La nuit, je ne sais pas si ça t'est déjà arrivé, Sarah, mais d'avoir une espèce de sentiment de vertige quand tu t'imagines tous les kilomètres d'étoiles qui sont au-dessus de nos têtes. Je ne sais pas toi, mais en tout cas, moi, des fois, ça peut m'effrayer. Alors, le ravissement aussi, l'enchantement de la nuit, de l'obscurité, la beauté de la lumière, la beauté de... aussi avoir... on souhaitait, impliquer le spectateur dans une espèce de quête, à l'obliger peut-être à avancer son corps un petit peu pour qu'il travaille, pour voir ce qui se passe. Et des fois, il peut peut-être même y avoir des moments de recul parce que là, il ne peut pas ne pas voir parce que c'est trop lumineux. Je ne veux pas trop en dire parce que ça comporte c'est comme des espèces de surprises aussi qu'on veut présenter au spectateur, mais il y a quelques scènes où... en fait, il y a des scènes où on ne sait pas du tout ce qu'on regarde. Il nous arrive quelque chose et on ne sait pas très bien à quoi on a affaire. On est presque devant un corps étranger et c'est aussi une façon d'engager le spectateur différemment.
Oui, vous avez dit dans un commentaire que vous pensez que ça force l'alliance, ça donne l'alliance une opportunité pour prendre une vue plus... En anglais, on dirait compassionate ou une vue plus sympa envers eux-mêmes. Est-ce que vous pouvez élaborer sur ça?
Oui, ben c'est, je dirais, je vais essayer d'élaborer puis d'être le plus simple possible, mais je dirais, là, je peux parler de mon expérience, en fait, et de l'intuition que j'en ai par rapport à l'ensemble de la pièce et comment les gens vont le recevoir. Mais je parlais entre autres de cette expérience, de cette scène où on ne sait pas très bien ce qu'on regarde. C'est assez confrontant, mais d'une façon vertigineuse. Il y a comme un vertige. Et on dirait que ça nous oblige à plonger dans nous-mêmes, en fait. Et à mesurer, au fur et à mesure qu'on est en contact avec la scène, à mesurer dans quelle mesure on est prêt à s'engager dans ce genre de rencontre-là, ce genre de rendez-vous. Là. Puis en même temps, c'est tellement abstrait que c'est confrontant ça aussi d'être autant... Parce que j'avoue, la première fois que moi j'ai été exposée à cette scène-là, j'ai été un petit peu... j'étais presque émue, presque bouleversée en fait. Puis en même temps, je me disais, ben non, Catherine, c'est juste une proposition là, de lumière. Il n'y a pas de raison que tu te mettes dans cet état. Alors de juste d'être confrontée à ça, d'être en dialogue permanent avec moi-même... Ça m'a mis dans une disposition particulière après pour continuer à recevoir le personnage de la Jamais sombre, j'imagine, cette femme-là qui erre dans cet univers-là qui est tellement bizarre, des fois, tellement incompréhensible, en fait. Oui, j'allais dire, et ça, c'est à travers des choses toutes simples que Marc nous a proposées et aussi que Michel nous propose à travers le son. Aussi, Michel essaye de prolonger cette dynamique-là avec le spectateur.
J'étais aussi curieuse à savoir, par rapport à vous trois travailler ensemble, est-ce que ça aurait été possible de travailler dans cette procédure comme ça si vous n'avez pas tellement travaillé ensemble depuis des années, parce que vous êtes tous collaborateurs, collaboratrices depuis des années avec vos projets, donc faire quelque chose un peu comme en derrière, in reverse, est-ce que c'était sûrement possible parce que vous avez travaillé tellement ensemble?
Ben, c'est sûr que ça l'a facilité énormément les choses parce que l'apprivoisement qui était à faire, c'était avec la matière comme telle et pas les uns avec les autres. On se connaît suffisamment bien, on se fait suffisamment confiance pour vraiment plonger dans les propositions réciproques et s'abandonner aussi à pas avoir... parce qu'il y a eu des propositions aussi qui n'ont pas été concluantes, puis ça prenait beaucoup de confiance et d'humilité par rapport à soi-même et aux autres pour oser proposer, plonger, se tromper, puis faire des détours quand c'était nécessaire ou... Ben, effectivement, donc je pense que ça a beaucoup facilité les choses.
Finalement, quand les gens vont quitter la salle de spectacle, qu'est-ce que vous espérez, le sentiment qu'ils vont tenir avec eux quand ils quittent après avoir vu Jamais sans bruit?
Ben, on espère qu'ils aient ressenti le spectacle plus que de l'apprécier, par exemple. Ça, c'est le vœu ultime, que les gens aient l'impression qu'ils ont vécu quelque chose, qu'ils ont traversé quelque chose. Pour moi, c'est ce spectacle-là, c'est une traversée, d'abord et avant tout.
Super, j'ai tellement hâte de le voir. Je vous remercie tellement pour avoir pris le temps de me parler de ça aujourd'hui. Merci, Catherine.
Merci beaucoup à toi. Mais on se reverra. Tu viens quel soir?
Je ne sais pas encore, mais parler de la chiaroscuro et le vertige, mais aussi l'idée de nuit et jouer avec la lumière, je me sens que je veux déjà être dans la scène, dans la noirceur, en train de, comme vous avez parlé de l'audience, qui va tenir leur corps en avance pour essayer de vous voir. C'est une description magique pour moi.
Ben, je te souhaite une belle traversée alors.
That was Catherine Tardif, dancer and choreographer of La Jamais Sombre at the Festival Transamérique. The show is June 9th to the 12th at Edifice Wilder. The June 10th show invites you to meet the artists after the presentation. For tickets and information and to see the rest of the programming, visit fta.ca. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard Amy Blackmore at the helm of the 30th Annual Montreal Fringe Festival, Johanna Netter on a casual reconstruction and strike through at the Mai, collaboration with her friend Nadia Mir. You can see it online Friday and Saturday at the Mai, and choreographer and dancer Catherine Tardif of La Jamais Sombre at the FTA next week. A big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under archives, and I invite you to listen to Le Labo Fringe Buzz, the Fringe Buzz Lab, a podcast produced by the team at The Fringe, led by Sarah Grenier-Lafosse and Corey Volson, and co-hosted by myself and Véronique Raymond. Find it wherever you find your podcasts, like Apple or Spotify. Remember, the Festival Transamérique and The Fringe are in full swing. You can check them out at fta.ca and montrealfringe.ca. Get your tickets and get out there. Thank you to the staff at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Stay safe.
Can music give you what you need? Does sound have the power to process complex emotions? Can placebos help?
Audio.
How are you today?
I'm Erin.
And I'm Julia.
How are you
and
today?
We're here to offer a kind of help with Audio Placebo Plaza. For 1 week, we offer everyday people customized positive messages, audio creations, healing frequencies, binaural beads, ASMR, and more. From June 11th to 16th at 6835 Rue Saint-Hubert and on undefined.fm.
This project is produced by Undefined Radio and co-presented by Tony Pearl Popolo and CKUT.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's going to be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Small can spread quickly, like a ripple. If enough of us do our part by getting vaccinated, we can start a wave. A wave of Canadians helping each other return to the people and places we love. We can all help by getting vaccinated. Learn more at canada.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the Government of Canada.
Can music give you what you need? Does sound have the power to process complex emotions? Can placebos help? How are you today?
I'm Erin.
And I'm Julia.
How are you
and
today?
We're here to offer a kind of help with Audio Placebo Plaza. For 1 week, we offer everyday people customized positive messages, audio creations, healing frequencies, binaural beads, ASMR, and more. From June 11th to 16th at 6835 Rue Saint-Hubert and on undefined.fm.
This project is produced by Undefined Radio and co-presented by Tony Pearl Popolo and CKUT.
Good evening and welcome to the June 3rd edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a lecture entitled Remake the World. It's brought to us through the kind graces of Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. It was recorded in San Francisco and Brooklyn on May 4th, 2021. Our two lecturers tonight are Rebecca Solnit and Astra Taylor. Rebecca Solnit is an award-winning essayist and environmental historian.